Please help me welcome our speaker tonight. He is Dave from Bristol, and his home group is Precisely How.
Cool, there's a clock here. Hi, everybody. My name is Dave Weiner, and I am an alcoholic. I want to thank the group and Jeff for the invitation. It's always a privilege to be invited to do something for Alcoholics Anonymous, and Stacy for riding up with me to help me keep me out of my head on the way up. We had some good conversation, and a couple friends that came from a distance. Brian and Meg, who came from Ambler, and Ira and Alex, who came from Bristol. I'm actually from Newtown, but I got sober in Bristol and in Levittown, and that's where I spend most of my time. So I kind of identify with being from Bristol. I don't know why. It's funny. How do you like my jacket? Looks pretty good. It looks nice. Yeah, I got the whole way up. I didn't tell Stacy this, but I had this in my head. There's this song, and some of you may know it, some of you not. But it's like I want to pop some tags. I got $20 in my pocket. This is my come up. This is somebody's grandfather's jacket. I got about $4 on this, but it's part cashmere. It's really actually quite spiffy. So, but in all seriousness, as I said, my name is Dave Weinerman, and I'm an alcoholic. And my sober date is April 28th, 2006, and I have a home group. My home group is the Precisely How Speakers Group in Bristol, Pennsylvania. I have a sponsor. I sponsor men, and you know, it's a pretty cool deal. I guess really the place to start is the beginning. And I have a when I was 6 days old. Go back. I remember when I was 6 days old, my parents came to the hospital and picked me up. I was adopted. I was brought into a home to two people that couldn't have children, wanted children more than anything else in the world. I was brought into a home that was just absolute love. I mean, they doted upon me. I had everything, parents were of modest means. My father was in advertising. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. We lived in Center City until I was about 8 years old. And, I had everything, everything I could possibly want, and certainly showered with love. When I was eight, we moved out into the suburbs, a little town called Jenkintown in Montgomery County. A little brick house, white picket fence. There's tons of kids in the neighborhood. We used to play street hockey, kick the can. There was a 5 o'clock whistle. It was like living in Mayberry. It was 5 o'clock whistle, and at lunchtime, the whistle would go off. You go home for lunch, go back out, 5 o'clock, the whistle would go off. Tons of kids in the neighborhood my age. Really a beautiful, beautiful, childhood. I had some learning disabilities and trouble. Mom was always there to help me. Just absolutely would do anything for me. I made it through high school. I was afforded the opportunity to go to college. I ended up, I went to a four-year college out in New York, Pennsylvania. I made it through that. In college, I met a real nice young lady. She went to a different school. She went to Westchester, and we fell in love. We got engaged. We were going to do all the right things. She was a year behind me. We were going to wait until I finish school and I get a job. We were going to wait until she gets out of school, she gets a job. We do all that. We get married. We saved our money. We paid for our own wedding. We come back from our honeymoon. We go to settlement on our first home. Right back from our honeymoon, we end up having three beautiful children. Right out of college, I get a job with a little manufacturing company. They want me to develop a division of the company for them, sales and marketing. Apparently, I had a knack for that. And by the time I was 26, 27, 28 years old, I was making a six-figure income. We would buy, and it would go straight up from there, well into the six figures. We would, buy a bigger house. We would end up buying a bigger house. I had a 38-foot boat. We had beautiful cars. You know, in a lot of ways you could say what I was living was the American dream. Everything that you could, you know, that you worked for, self-made, you know, earned everything. It was an ideal life. At age 36, I would end up in my first rehab. And at age 41, I would end up living in a recovery house. Now, I ask you, what's wrong with this picture? And I present it that way because I think there's always, my experience is that there's always somebody, maybe you're new, maybe you've been around for a little while, that thinks that, you know what, if I'd have just gotten that job, if it hadn't been for the way my parents were, if it hadn't been for, if I'd gotten that girl, if she hadn't left me, if she'd come back, I wouldn't be sitting here today. And I don't think that any of those things make you an alcoholic, and the fact that I had basically a perfect life makes me an alcoholic. What makes me an alcoholic is the fact that I have a mind with an obsession that condemns me to drink against my will, and a body that condemns me to die if I do. That's what makes me an alcoholic. No circumstances. Now, there is a spiritual malady involved with this thing, and perhaps circumstances in your life can fuel a spiritual malady, but they don't make you an alcoholic. I can look back now, and most of what I'm going to say is going to be sort of in hindsight, because my perspective certainly has changed over the last almost 7 years on what has occurred and what has happened in my life and what is responsible for that. But I can look back as being a little kid, long before I ever took my first drink. And, we talk about that spiritual malady, and you hear it put so many different ways. But I have a memory of being 3 years old. I was 3, 4, 5 years old. And in our dining room in the house, we had a drawer, and in that drawer I kept a bunch of little junk toys, stuff you get in Cracker Jack boxes, stuff you get in cereal boxes. And I can remember over a 3 or 4 year period, starting at that young age, I would have then described it as I always felt bored. I was bored. I was looking for something. And I would go into this drawer, and it was like there was this, almost like this haunting memory of something that was in that drawer, a toy. I couldn't remember what it was, but I couldn't forget about it. And I would search, and I would look, and I would look through that drawer. And I just had this feeling that if I found that toy, then that feeling I had was going to go away. And I'd look, and I wouldn't find it. I'd close the drawer. 10 minutes later, I'd come back. I'd dump it out, and I'd look some more. And I never found that thing. But I did that routine for several years. And that type of routine, that type of searching for something, and I call it that thing that you can't put your finger on. I've always had that thing that I couldn't put my finger on. Something just wasn't quite right. No matter what was going on in my life, something wasn't quite right. That thing that I couldn't put my finger on. At age 12, I would have my first drink. Me and a buddy were coming home from school one day, and we decided, it's just one of those, any other day, what do you want to do? I don't know, what do you want to do? Let's get drunk. Okay. And we go to his dad's house. His dad was a single parent. He was at work. We open up the liquor cabinet. We start taking a couple pops from the bottles. There's 6 or 8 bottles in that cabinet. Two very distinct different things happened. I took 2 drinks. He took 2 drinks. He said, I'm going to go make a snack. I'm hungry. He went into the kitchen to make that snack, and I was immediately drinking to overcome a craving beyond my control, and I was drinking to overcome that feeling of that thing that I couldn't put my finger on, that I wasn't aware of, but was there. And I took those few drinks, and it was like, for the first time in my life, I had been living in black and white, and somebody turned on the color. I mean, I remember it like it was yesterday, that looking around his house, and I had been in that house, if it wasn't 100 times, it was 1,000 times. And looking at the curtains and looking at the furniture and the carpet and looking at, just thinking everything was so, it was such a nice house. It was so nice and it was so warm and it was such a, just an inviting, happy place to be. And what a great friend. Just a feeling of warmth. You're not aware of what was going on. It says in our literature that, we lose the power of choice, and a lot of times that happens long before we realize it. I think that was it. I mean, it was that moment. Now, my progression of alcoholism would be over a long period of time. I mean, like I said, I didn't hit my first rehab until I was 36. But I would look back now and see that my life is a series of trying to make arrangements. My life was a series of trying to make that thing that wasn't quite right feel better. You know, not aware, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking. You know, having no idea. You know, and it talks in the first step says, you know, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. It's like two different parts of the step. I mean, the first 52 pages, 51 pages of the book are dedicated to that we've lost, you know, we can't control our drinking. Then you get into that little part where at page 60 where it says we're now at step 3. And you read a page and a half to get to where it says we're now at step 3. I mean, what is that describing? That's describing the unmanageability of my life. And the unmanageability of my life, you know, my life certainly would fall apart as a result of drinking and other substances. But my life was unmanageable from the time I was that little kid looking in that drawer trying to find something that was going to fix it, that was going to make me feel okay. My life would become a series of trying to make arrangements. I'd have that drink, and you know, it was my whole high school, college was all revolved around drinking, and I didn't have the where I would drink every day of my life. I didn't wake up and drink, but I would have these times, and I call them the incidents, where I clearly I had no control over when. How I was going to drink when I drank. And I called it was like the light switch. Because I mean, for a long time, I think that was part of what sort of drug out my progression of alcoholism was that, it would fool me mentally, the fact that I could go out and drink 2 weekends in a row and there wouldn't be any incident. But then that third weekend or that fourth, whatever random time it was like somebody hit a switch that I had no control over and I don't know what happened. And I would wake up from that and I would be like, well, you know, you didn't eat enough, or you shouldn't have drank that, or you shouldn't have drank that. And I would always figure out some way of why it was my fault and why I could do that fine. And it would fool me for a long time because it wouldn't happen every single time. But as time would go on, those incidents would happen, you know, more and more frequently. I would end up, I started traveling a lot for business. And one of the things in traveling was, you know, it was like the drink. There came a point where I started drinking a lot more frequently. My wife said to me, you know, at one point, you know, you really should cut back on your drinking. You're drinking, you know, 5, 6, sometimes 7 nights a week. You know, and all right, you know, and she started marking on the calendar how much, you know, how often I was drinking. And I think that was the first time that I ever really started to feel that little bit of powerlessness in my life, because as soon as you put a limit on what I could drink or control, the bottle started getting hidden in the garage. The bottle started getting hidden in the car. I would have that endless glass of gin. Every time she would leave the room, I would fill it back up, but I only had one. It was just one that I just kept refilling over and over and over again. But I started traveling for business, and I'm not going to go too much into it with the specifics of the substances, but I believe they are substances as they relate to my alcoholism. And as I would travel, you know, it was like I'm having constraints put on how much I can drink at home. I'm sent out on business ahead of time. So a lot of times, you know, days ahead of time, I'm there by myself. I'm in cities all over the country. And I would go out and I would have a few drinks. And all of a sudden, the idea that, you know what, I want to find something that's going to be a little bit more fun. I'm alone. Nobody's going to know. Let me seek something else. And I would try a little thing here, a little thing there, and I would end up, you know, missing appointments. I would end up, you know, things would happen, and I would come back home, and I would say to myself, I can't do that when I'm home. It's one thing when I'm away, nobody's around to find out, but I can't do that when I'm home. That becomes, well, you could do it once a week when you're home. That becomes, you can do it 2 times a week when you're home. That becomes, well, if I'm doing this, I'm really not drinking much, so therefore my wife is happy with the fact that I'm not drinking, and I must be doing well. And that would end up spiraling into various circumstances, and again, I'm not really big on the war story thing, but that would end up spiraling into circumstances that would get my back against the wall and end me up in that first rehab. And I got to tell you, I didn't go to that first rehab. You know, sometimes you hear people say they go to these rehabs, you know, I did it only because I was forced to go. I could see clearly the direction my life was headed. I mean, at this point, I have 3 children. I have a beautiful home. I have a lot of responsibility. And that's another one of the things, too, that I think that was able to sort of hold that alcoholism at bay, that progression for a little while, because I was ambitious. My career was important to me. My family was important to me. It was important to me enough to hold those, sort of use willpower a little bit to sort of hold that stuff off for a while. I end up in that first rehab. I come out of that rehab after the 28 days, and you know, I mean, they gave me a certificate, said I completed the program successfully, you know. So, and it's rehabilitation. I figure, you know, 28 days in this place, I'm good to go. Well, I start going back to work, and you know, mind you, I have spent most of my life off and on going to some sort of therapy because I was always, you know, always depressed. I was always, you know, it was that thing that I couldn't put my finger on. I was always looking, seeking some sort of answer to this feeling. And why is everything in my life is so good, and I feel guilty about not feeling good? What's wrong? You know, and it's like I always ask myself, what's wrong? What's wrong? I get out of this rehab, I start going back to work, and I am so filled with guilt, remorse. I can't, anxiety. I can't go back and face the people I work with. Now, I got 50, 60 people at this point that are working under me. You know, these people have a lot of respect for me. They like me. And I've always, my whole life, and especially in my career, had this feeling of that I'm a fraud. This is all a mistake. This is an accident. I'm not supposed to be doing as well as I am. All this stuff is going to go away. They're going to find out. And I have to go back now and face these people after what I feel like is the worst thing in the world. And I can't deal with it. I mean, I don't know what's going on. You know, I'm 30 days sober. I'm 60 days sober. And I'm progressively getting worse. I'm getting so filled with anxiety and misery. I remember driving one day to work and calling my wife at the time and saying, you know, I had to pull over. I'm in tears. I am in tears. And I said to her, I don't know what's wrong with me. I don't know what's wrong with me. But I can't live like this. I don't know what's wrong. Said, if this is the way it's going to be, I think I'd rather be dead. And we're in the whole crisis mode, and the specialists are called, and there's more doctor's visits, and more, you know, a prescription for this, a prescription for that. And needless to say, I can only take that for so long. I know what's going to make me feel better. You know, even though I don't want to, there is relief. And I will seek that relief. And this will be an off-and-on pattern for the next several years of the trying. And things will start getting really bad. I mean, I don't tell you, you know, make the long story part of the short, that I would eventually be to the point where I am taking out second mortgages on my home without anybody knowing it. I'm spending, you know, juggling the money with, you know, paying the bills with the credit cards, cash advances with the credit cards to keep it as seem as if the cash flow and everything is staying afloat. And in the meantime, amassing hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of secret debt. And I crossed 2 lines. After the second or third rehab and this same repeating pattern, I pick up the drink again and I decide, I make this decision that and it really was sort of like a default decision because I had no idea that there was any other decision to go, but the thought that the reason why you felt this inadequacy, the reason why you felt so horrible inside, the reason why that thing you can't put your finger on just won't go away, is because this is really what you're meant to be. This is really what you were supposed to be all along. This whole thing with the house and being the dad and being the husband and being the good neighbor and being the good employee and being the good employer is all just a ruse. That's why you have felt like a fraud all along, because you are a fraud. And I made the decision that this every day waking up and saying to myself, today is going to be the day. I'm not going to take a drink today. And doing it over and over and over, that I'm not doing that anymore. This is it. I'm going on to go to the bitter end, trying to blot out my intolerable existence the best I can. And that lasted about 6 months. And that brought me to a point where, and during this 6-month period, my wife would throw me out of the house. I was not allowed within 1,000 feet of my home or my children. I would end up losing that job. The house would go, the boat would go, the cars would go, everything would go. I'm living in my car on the streets of Philadelphia, and I get to the point where the drinking is I'm just as miserable when I'm drinking as when I'm not. I can't stand it anymore. And I make the conscious decision, this is the next line I cross, I make the conscious decision that I'm going to kill myself, that my children, my ex-wife, my mother, all the people that love me will be better off without me. Yes, it will hurt them. They will get over it. And they'll be better off in the long run without me here. And I set up to do this. I find a spot that I go to. I have everything I need. I have a hose in the from the exhaust into the car, and I'm just going to start. I'm just going to drink till I'm ready to pass out. Hit that ignition, and it's going to be done. And something happened. I'm preparing to do this, and tears just start flying out of my eyes. And it's weird because I can't say that it wasn't a sad crying, it wasn't a happy crying, it was just tears. I mean, almost like spouting from my face. And now, mind you, I was not brought up with any religion. There was no talk of God in my home. Over the years, my foxhole prayers were always, "How can I get myself out of this? Who can I call? What can I do to get me out of this? What can I do to figure this one out?" And I just cried out these simple words. I just cried out, "God, what's wrong with me?" And I fell asleep. And I woke up, the sun was coming up. And first thought in my head, and I had not been thinking this the day before, I had not been thinking this a month before, was try rehab, go back one more time. I ended up getting into a detox, and that was all the insurance would do. I spent like three or four days there. And I went to the counselor. I said, you keep sending me back home. I don't have a home to go to anymore, but something's got to be different. And he said, "Have you ever tried a recovery house?" And I said, "I don't even know what that is." He's like, "Well," and he talked to me about it a little bit. I said, "Fine, I'll try that." I ended up going to this recovery house in Levittown. And, it's funny. After 3 days, 5 days before I was ready to kill myself, I remember walking in that recovery house and looking around, and I had this mental picture of what a recovery house was that was totally different than what it actually was. But I remember walking in there and looking around and thinking to myself, and this is how amazing and how resilient the ego actually is. Looking around there, thinking to myself, "I have lost everything. This isn't so bad. I'll stay here for a week or two, get my act together, and I'll figure it out." I mean, that was it. I was ready, a week or two in this place, I'm going to be good. Well, one of the rules at this recovery house is that you have to get a sponsor, you have to join one of the 12-step fellowships. And I'm there for about 5 days, and I don't have a sponsor yet, and I'm out standing outside of a meeting with a couple guys from the house, and there's this young guy sort of hovering around the crowd. I think he knew the people I was with. And I just sort of casually mentioned to the guys, "I really need to get a sponsor. I've been here for 5 days. I don't have a sponsor yet." And this kid, this kid was 6'2", and I swear it was like he had springs in his shoes. He heard me say that. He came bouncing into the crowd, and he's bobbing up and down on these spring shoes, and he's got this big, goofy grin on his face, and he's like, "I'll sponsor you." And I remember looking him up and down and thinking to myself, I mean, this kid was 19 years old. I'm 41. I'm thinking, I'm old enough to be your father. And in my mind, I don't even know what a sponsor, what it means. I think I listen to somebody that tells you what to do, runs your life, bosses you around. And I look him up and down and think to myself, they'll probably get the upper hand on you like that. All right? And he's like, "Come over to my house tomorrow." I go over to his house that next day. And it's really an amazing thing. He sits down, he starts talking to me, and he starts talking to me about him. He starts talking to me about how he drank. He starts talking to me about how he felt. He starts talking to me in his own words about that thing he couldn't put his finger on and the way he drank. It's like it says on page 18, just like that magic that happened with Dr. Bob and or with Bill and Dr. Bob. I mean, and it hasn't changed in 79 years. One ex-problem drinker is properly armed with the facts. who has found this solution can win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a matter of a few hours. And in that 45 minutes we talked, he went from this 19-year-old kid that I could get the upper hand on to somebody that I would do anything he asked. Because he clearly had felt like I did. In his short period of time, he clearly drank like I did, and he was clearly different. And he had a real smile on his face, and he had that fresh look in his head, that fresh skin, and that little glint in his eye. And I was willing to do whatever he asked me to do. And we opened up the book, and he started right into the doctor's opinion, and started explaining to me about what restless, irritable, and discontent means. How this is that thing that I couldn't put my finger on that I've had all my life, and that I have an abnormal reaction when I take a drink. My friend, when we were 12 years old, he took two drinks, and he probably thought, you know what, I feel a little woozy, I feel funny, I don't like it, I feel like I'm losing control, my dad might be home soon. I took two drinks, and it was all over. I did not stop. A totally different reaction. He explained what an abnormal reaction was. He explained the mental obsession. He explained that when I'm sitting in my car and I'm heading home from work and I know that if I go out one more time, if I go out and take one more drink, day after day I'm saying it's not going to be it. And it's not a sense of impending doom. I knew doom was coming. I knew I was going to lose that job, and I knew if I lost that job, my children would lose their home. And I wanted more than anything in the world not to do that to my children. I wanted more than anything in the world. It says the baffling feature is the complete inability to put it down, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. I had the greatest necessity in the world. I didn't want to do that. I'm not a horrible person. I did not want to do that to my children. I didn't want to turn their world upside down, break their trust like that. I could not. I couldn't not do that. So we sit down, and here's the amazing thing. I said that sometimes I look at it from looking back. I didn't realize that at the time, but just 6 or 7 days earlier, I cried out to God, "What's wrong with me?" And this 19-year-old kid shows up in my life, and for the first time in my life, he explains to me exactly what's wrong with me. I've been going to doctors and counselors, psychiatrists, psychologists for years trying to figure out what was wrong with me. And this 19-year-old kid, in 45 minutes, let me know what was wrong with me. And I can tell you, it wasn't all good news. I mean, step one is not really good news. You know, step one basically tells you you're screwed. But he went right on. I mean, he moved me through those first three steps in 2.5 hours, 3 hours. We were on our knees saying that third step prayer. And first thing he said to me, he opened up, and it's in There Is a Solution or in Bill's story. But he said to me, he said, you've got two options. He said, you can go on to the bitter end trying to blot out your miserable, intolerant existence the best you can, or you could accept spiritual help. And a light bulb went off. You know, I mean, I was not a God person. I was not spiritual. But the fact of the matter is, it occurred to me, I realized that 6 months earlier, I had made that choice, not knowing that there was another option. So for me, it was a no-brainer. He went through some of the other typical questions. You know, God is or God isn't. God is everything or he's nothing at all. You know, what is our choice to be? And I was, you know, I was not... necessarily, I didn't have any great faith. I didn't necessarily believe. I did not believe in God. I was skeptical about the whole thing, but I could see there was something in him, and I was willing to move on. We got down on our knees, and we said that third step prayer. Now, I look back now, and I see that moment, you know, in my car, a lot different than I did a year sober, 2 years sober, 3 years sober. I know today that was the grace of God. I know it was. I know at that moment, I was preparing to kill myself, and this self, this ego that we talk about, that the book talks about, it had a moment of deflation. It had a moment of deflation. That ego had been like a parasite that was trying to suck every little bit of living juice out of me. But at that last moment, when the toast that it was existing from was going to go away and it would lose its job, it deflated, it decided to back off, and that was just enough for the grace of God to enter into my life and to just put my will lined up with his momentarily. And the grace of God is the unmerited gift from God. I did absolutely nothing to deserve that. If anything, I did everything to not deserve that. I did absolutely nothing. Today I know that, you know, in it's God of our own conception, my God is all power, all wisdom, all kindness, all love, all forgiveness, all the time. That is my God's only nature. That is my God's only nature. It is an impersonal God in the sense that that same love, wisdom, forgiveness, and just everything grace that it has to offer is available to everybody all the time. It wasn't just special to me. God didn't stop and say, "Ooh, look, Dave's going to kill himself." Dave's ego got out of the way. The only thing that ever stands between me and that grace, and me and God's grace, is me. And I got out of the way accidentally long enough to set me in a path along his will. Now, and I continued to go through those steps. I wrote that fourth step. I did that fifth step with that young man. He sent me into the other room right after it. He didn't even say, "Go home and take that hour." He sent me to the other room. He said, "You go sit in there." He said, "For an hour if you need to, however long, you thank God from the bottom of your heart that you know him better." And I sat there, and I reviewed those first five proposals. And I didn't feel a whole lot, but we went. As soon as I was done, he came out. He said, "We're going to do step six and seven right now." And he had a list from that fifth step of defects of character that he'd been keeping while we were doing it. And he explained to me, we got down and we said that seven-step prayer. And I went out and I started making amends. And my life started to change very quickly. This all happened in a 4, 5, 6 week period. My life started to change very, very quickly. Things started to change for the better. I got to think, so I go back and I think about the steps now. And to me, you know, in a nutshell view, going through those steps, especially 4 through 9, you know, we make that decision in the third step when we get down on our knees that God is going to be the Father, we are the children, he is the principal, we are his agent. It says later, you know, this, we will have a new employer. And I believe that is part of the decision. I'm making this decision that I'm going forth with this to enable me to continue to stand in that grace that was given to me as a gift. And in that fourth step, for that new employer, it's like my job application. It's like my resume. Except unlike the resume I would write if I was actually trying to get a job, I'm putting the truth on it. And I'm putting down the facts of, you know, the things that have been in the way, that have been blocking me. And my fifth step is like between God, myself, and another human being. It's like my job interview for this job that I agreed to, this new employer. And if I'm honest in that, my God, like I said, is all forgiving. I don't even think my God is actually forgiving, because my God isn't judgmental in the first place. I am not forgiving. And when I forgive, I'm forgiven. That's how it feels. It's not a matter of that God forgiving me. That God never judged me to begin with. In order for God, my God to be forgiving, my God would have had to been keeping score and been angry at me. My God never was. And I do this job interview, and we get down on our knees. We take a look at these defects of character. Am I willing to have them removed? And when are you more willing to actually have these things, to ask God to remove these things, than right after you've done your fifth step and they're put glaringly in your face? And that's basically what we did. And we got down on our knees and we said that seven-step prayer. You know, and it's like being sworn in for that job. You know, not only are you asking to have these things removed so you can do the job, it's like being sworn in. My Creator, I am now. Why am I now willing? Was a real surrender come at the third step, or was that the decision to carry out the actions that would allow me to surrender? My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my new job, my usefulness to you and my fellows. And what is the best way to get to know God is through my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here right now, not in a week, a month, 6 months, as I go out from here right now. You're hired. And we got a job for you. Your first job is make a list of the people you harmed and go out and fix it. That's my new job. That's where I start. And I go out and I start doing that. And these promises in the book start to come true, just like they say. tell you a couple quick stories. What it's like. I always like to talk about those. There's 9-step promises. And so you'll know a new peace. You'll comprehend the word serenity. Financial insecurity will leave you. All those wonderful promises. Well, one of the things I like to, my experience has been, and I like to tell the guys I work with, is that if those promises are starting to come true in your life, well, whoop-dee-doo. That's great. I mean, it actually is great. It's wonderful when those promises start to come true in your life. But you're also out in this path making amends. And in the 12th step, there's this second part of it that says we need to practice these principles in all our affairs. And you can say, well, it's practicing these principles. It's a living amends. You can call it whatever you want. But if you want to ask yourself, if these promises are coming true in your life, who are the people in your life that you've took these things from? Who have you taken peace from? Whose serenity have you taken? Who have you created financial insecurity in their lives? And what are you doing to put those things back into their lives? Not just the words you say when you make the amends. The words you say are very important. But it's, in my opinion, 5%. It's your actions that follow that make all the difference in the world. When I was about 2 years sober, that house I told you we lost, it took a little while before the bank started banging on the door. My ex-wife was able to take in an elderly grandmother instead of her parents paying the nursing home, paid her. I contributed as much. I started working again, in a career-type job at about 6 months sober. I was able to make my, I pay a lot of alimony, a lot of child support. We were able to hang on to it for a while, but it got to the point where she couldn't keep the grandmother anymore, and the bills piled up, and the house went. And one of the things, just back up a second here, is I think that if you know me outside of the rooms, whether it be at a meeting, outside the meeting, during the day at work, anywhere I go, I'm one of these people that always has I have a smile on my face a lot. And if you ask me how I'm doing, my answer is phenomenal. My answer is amazing. My answer is fantastic. Wonderful. It's always that answer. And there's a lot of people. I think there's some people that occasionally get annoyed at that. Couldn't be that good all the time. You're one of those guys. And so I want to tell you the story. At 2 years ago, the house has to go. We were fortunate enough, my ex-wife was able to sell the house and get whatever little bit of equity was left in it out. But I needed to come and help her move. She couldn't afford movers. I had to rent a U-Haul. I had to hire some guys that I knew from a recovery house. And that morning came, and it was to pack up. And I couldn't do it. I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to go and pack up my kids. I didn't have the courage to do that. I had to pray that morning. I had to pray hard. I had to pray, God, give me the strength to do what I need to do. Please help me. I can't do this. And I went, I dragged myself there. I got the truck. I brought it there. We packed up. And as everything was packed, it was bedtime to go. My two daughters at the time were about 8 and 10. And they were standing about 8 feet away from me. And they were sitting there looking at the house, and they were crying. And they come in, and they looked over at me, and they said, Daddy, we don't want to leave our rooms. Daddy, we don't want to leave our house. It was the only house they ever knew. My ex-wife was going to be going to an uncle's house to stay for a while because she hadn't been able to find an apartment yet for them to move into. She couldn't find a place with the dog. The stuff was going in storage. These little girls were scared to death. Their world had been turned upside down. An amazing thing happened that day. I didn't have any magic words for them. I couldn't make it go away. But I experienced things that I've never experienced before in my life. I experienced for the first time compassion. See, those little girls were crying, and I cried with them. And I cried with them because I felt their pain. See, the old man would have wanted to run. The old man would have thought, how can you make me feel this way? I've been sober for 2 years now. Don't you know how hard I tried? How can you make me feel this way? I never crossed my mind. I just felt their pain. And I had this overwhelming sense that it was going to be okay. I didn't know how, I didn't know why, but I was there. I was present for those little girls. I was there for them, and I haven't ever been more than 5 minutes away from them living since. Now, if you'd have asked me, only thing that drink never crossed my mind. Now, I had been saying it for a while at this point. You know, I would raise my hand in a meeting. I'm Dave Weinerman. I'm a recovered alcoholic. And I've stopped saying that as an introduction. Not that I, you know, it's fine if you want to do that. And I believe we do recover. It always, as a newcomer, made me feel like that guy, you know, he thinks he's special. So that was maybe my twisted perception. But I figured maybe my twisted perception is the same as some other new people's twisted perceptions. But at that moment, standing there, experiencing that compassion, experiencing their pain, the thought of a drink never came into my mind. The thought of running never came into my mind. And I knew at that moment, at least right then, I could say I was recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. A drink did not cross my mind. So when you see me at a meeting, at the gas station, wherever it is, and I'm smiling, and you ask me, how are you? And I say, I'm phenomenal. I say, I'm amazing. I very well may have just packed up my children's belongings and sent them off into storage and had that kind of day. But had you seen me that evening, there would have been a smile on my face, and I would have said, I'm amazing. Not because it wasn't a sad day, not because it wasn't a hard day, because today I have a God as a result of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that have brought me to that solution that I can absolutely, positively rely on no matter what. And that is amazing. That is beyond my wildest dreams. That is not what I dreamed of when I came in. That's not what I thought I was going to get. And it so far surpasses anything that I could have possibly imagined. When I sat down with that 19-year-old kid, I came hoping that maybe this would work for me. That second step says we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I came hoping that just maybe, that could work for me. I didn't have any great faith in God. I didn't even kind of believe in God. I wasn't sure. There's a story in the book about the American businessman who goes to Switzerland and he meets up with Carl Jung, the psychiatrist. And you really, you know, if you're familiar at all with the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, I mean, you can kind of credit, you know, Carl Jung. Bill called him one of the founders of AA. You can credit him with the solution part, with the spiritual answer to our malady, to alcoholism. You know, Bill and Towns Hospital and Dr. Silkworth, they figured out the physical aspect of it. They figured out the mental obsession, but they didn't figure out what the answer was. And Carl Jung told Roland Hazard, you need to go find something because I can't help you. And I just read something recently, and we'll close with this. I thought it was very cool. This came from a book called Further Along the Road Less Traveled, The Unending Journey Towards Spiritual Growth by M. Scott Peck. It was in this, there's a little section of here, and I'm just reading a little cut from it. He was interviewing Dr. Jung, and he asks Dr. Jung, he says, Dr. Jung, do you believe in God? And Dr. Jung answers, well, we use the word believe when we think that something is true, but we don't yet have a substantial body of evidence to support it. No, I don't believe in God. I know there's a God. I, too, know that there's a God. Thanks.